The Tom Woods Show, episode 1602.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, which I helped create, gives parents their mental health back and students a top-notch education. In addition to the traditional subjects, how about 2 years worth of business, as well as a course on personal finance for teens, a course on public speaking, the kinds of stuff nobody learns anywhere, but which will give your students a major leg up. Plus, through my link only, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you join. That link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. We are starting Bob Murphy Week on The Tom Woods Show, and I could not be happier. I did an episode number, 1357 in March of 2019, in which I took two people, Bob Murphy and Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center, and I did an episode in tribute to them. And I more or less said, if the libertarian movement weren't deranged and corrupt, these two would be held up as role models. They would be household names among all our folks for the amazing work they've done. I mean, Bob's a genius. That's obvious from reading his stuff. He's enormously productive. When you look through all the books he's written and the articles and the study guides he's written to the major thinkers in the tradition of Austrian economics, it's staggering what he's done. And the originality of his thinking as a libertarian theorist just cannot fail to impress someone. And when I look at some of the just downright mediocrities who are promoted in the official think tank world, it's just shocking. But you, because you're a Tom Woods Show listener, or you found out about Bob through the Mises Institute, you know better. You know all about Bob and what a great guy he is. Bob Murphy holds his PhD in economics from New York University. He's taught economics at the college level. He's got a financial newsletter, the Laura Murphy Report. He's the author of Choice, which is a book in the Austrian tradition. It really helps distill Mises' human action, basically. It's an accessible book of reasonable length, laying out the basic principles of Misesian economics. He's also the author of two books in the Politically Incorrect Guide series, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism and The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. The resources, again, I mean, he's written a textbook for, let's say, like maybe high school students, roughly, maybe really advanced middle schoolers, Lessons for the Young Economist. I'm going to have a whole bunch of Bob Murphy links up at tomwoods.com/1602. So let me say a couple things about what's coming up this week. First of all, I want to say something about episodes, because I just mentioned episode 1357. It used to be the case up until very, very, very recently that only the 300 most recent episodes of The Tom Woods Show were available on these various podcasting platforms like Apple Podcasts or whatever, Stitcher, whatever you use to listen. And that restriction existed for a long time. And then I discovered that there were plenty of podcasts that had every single one of their episodes easily available. So if you wanted to listen to one of the earlier episodes of The Tom Woods Show before the most recent 300, you would have had to go to tomspodcast.com and just scroll through and click and listen. And it's not as convenient as listening through some kind of podcatcher. Well, when I found out that it was possible to get all of them up, I said to my folks on my little team here, can you guys figure this out and do this? And now I'm happy to announce it is so. You go to Apple Podcasts or any of the other things you might use, Google Podcasts, whatever you use, you will now find that all 1,600 plus episodes of The Tom Woods Show are now available for your listening pleasure. It is amazing. So episode 1357, in which I pay tribute to Bob, is, you know, would have been almost on its way out. But now, don't worry about it, it's going to be up there in perpetuity because all the episodes are finally available conveniently for everybody. Anyway, so let's talk about this week. The first couple of episodes, this one and the one after, are a little more technical than the rest. And that is because we've got in Bob Murphy somebody who's a great original theorist, who's a great thinker, who's advanced our understanding in both of these areas, libertarianism and Austrian economics. And I do want to talk on, you know, let's say a higher level a little bit, because we have both a genius and a popularizer in Bob Murphy. And I want to know from him, where in libertarianism does he think we need to do more work? Where are their gaps? Where are their weaknesses? And likewise, the same question for Austrian economics, which we'll cover tomorrow. Then the rest of the week, we're more or less going to be primarily looking at really hard cases in libertarianism. And that's primarily what we're going to be doing. We're going to be looking at hard cases, not just the typical objections like who will build the roads. We've done episodes on that. But even concerns that libertarians themselves might have. You know, I'm not so sure we've got a really persuasive answer to such and such problem. We're going to talk to Bob about those. So it's going to be a terrific week. And of course, I want you to make sure and listen to Bob's new-ish podcast, The Bob Murphy Show, which you can find at bobmurphyshow.com. All right, that's a very long introduction for Bob Murphy. But now the rest of the episodes, I'll assume you've heard this introduction. We don't need to repeat it. Bob, welcome to Bob Murphy Week.
Glad to be here.
You really are the essential person here on Bob Murphy Week. I would say you are.
I know. In principle, you could get a co-host to do it, but really, if it's not me, I don't know how you could have Bob Murphy Week.
That's right. Certainly you're in the top three or four people who are most important to Bob Murphy Week. All right. So we're starting off, given how much stuff you've done in a lot of different areas and how much original stuff you've done, you've had an opportunity to dig into the nooks and crannies of libertarianism and libertarian theory and scholarship. And I wonder if in the course of doing that, you've said to yourself, you know, we really need more work done in this area or that area, or we're a little bit weak here. I wish we were stronger here. Sometimes I think people look at libertarianism, especially young people, and they view it as a closed system. You know, like everything's already been written. You know, Mises already wrote his books, and we already know how this would work and that would work and how we answer this question and that question. But are there areas indeed where there should be specific areas where there should be more work done and that would be helpful? So I have not conferred with you about what your examples of this are, so I'm just going to go with whatever you say. So start off with what would be your first suggestion?
Well, I think in terms of just developing the theory that, yeah, the property rights and how do people come to own property, I actually think that there should be more work done on that. And for example, some people may know who Rob Bradley is, and he's done a lot of work on how do you use homesteading theory. And Murray Rothbard was his PhD, you know, dissertation chairman for his PhD. And so he was trying to develop it when it comes to mineral resources. So the big picture is, you know, of course, people like the homesteading principle, but how do you actually apply that? And there's lots of interesting thought experiments, like David Friedman's raised some objections. And I don't know that the standard Rothbardian has a crisp answer to that stuff. So just to give you an example of what I mean, Tom. So somebody walks up to the edge of the ocean. The first human who discovered the ocean, what can he, like if he takes a little thimble full of red dye and dumps it in the ocean, does he own the whole ocean now? You know, things like that. Or you have a plot of land somewhere and suppose there's this huge deposit of oil underneath that goes out hundreds of miles in various directions, and you drill down and you hit that, what do you have the right to? Is it the oil that's just below, you know, in terms of if you were looking at a map and you saw like where your fence was and that went straight down, but what when you pump barrels of oil to the surface, doesn't that reduce the oil that somebody else who might be 10 miles down the road, if they drilled down and were hitting the same deposit, the same pool of oil underneath the surface? So lots of issues like that. I think there could be a lot more work done on that.
Okay. Now that's one of these areas where I do hear critics of libertarianism raise this, or sometimes it's friendly critics. You know, sometimes it's people within our tradition who say homesteading just doesn't answer all problems, or at least at the very least, you have to realize that in particular circumstances, there are just contingent facts that need to be dealt with. How would it be applied in this particular case? And so, in other words, libertarianism can provide you with a kind of a framework as to how to steep yourself in the problem. But then, as in the case of minerals, for example, there's going to be more information necessary in order to come up with a complete answer. Is that what you're saying?
Sure. Yeah. Just like in practice, how would that play out? And so, yeah, that's not a critique. That's just an area of where, yeah, you have the general principles, but just how do you apply it more? So that's like normal science, if you want to use, you know, that sort of thing rather than a paradigm shift. So that, yeah, that's how I would do it there. Or even, and I know this might get into issues with people in terms of IP, but like radio spectrum, stuff like that. It's not obvious that, you know, there would be a legal theory that developed, but before humans knew about radio waves, even if everybody were trying to obey the non-aggression principle or whatever they would have called it back then, once people understood how radio stations worked and then the possibility of a, quote, pirate radio station broadcasting and interfering with what the tower from the big established corporation was doing down the road, things like that where it's not so much information, but it really there are scarce things involved there, and it's not obvious, like, who owns the airwaves, or is it just or even can a plane, like, for example, in a free society, in a Rothbardian world, if a plane wants to take off from New York and go to California, how does that work? Do they have to get permission from every homeowner along the route? Because in principle, you know, something might fall off the plane and land on your roof. So it's not clear just how do you apply, even if we all agree on what the basic framework is, always, you know, self-ownership. And then when you find unowned natural resources and somehow, you know, some people like the idea of mixed your labor with it. Other people say that's kind of an arbitrary thing. But whatever the principle is, it's not clear in practice. Okay, how do judges make rulings in the real world, even in a free society?
Now, by the way, I do want to do an episode later in this week where I'm going to take some listener questions where they're the kind of questions people would ask Walter Block, but not quite that crazy. So it's not, you know, one-legged Martians on the moon and what would their rights be? It's nothing like that. But still, some of the difficult ones that we have to face.
Can
like
I tell
children,
you my favorite Walter Block story in that regard?
Please.
So I think he'd be fine with me sharing this. So I recently I had this zany idea and I emailed. I said, Walter, we should co-write an article where the premise is going to be if the God of the Old Testament were true, or if the Genesis account were true, then the God of the Old Testament would be the rightful owner of the entire universe, and therefore could set whatever rules he wanted, and he wouldn't be a tyrant, he would just be the landlord. And Walter wrote back and said, Bob, this is pretty weird, let me think about that. So I thought that was kind of an accomplishment that I got him to say, this is weird.
That is an accomplishment. That is, yeah. I don't know if you heard Walter Block Week on my show, but it had my favorite moment in the history of the show, which was the very last episode of Walter Block Week. I asked for a sneak preview of some of the topics he's covering in Defending the Undefendable Part 3.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts listing them, and I just burst out laughing, and I begged him for mercy. I said, stop, Walter, stop. I can't take it anymore. So anyway, we're going to do some hard questions. I was thinking here about, as you say, like hard questions in the sense of, you know, there's some emotion packed in them maybe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to really reassure people that they would be taken care of in a libertarian society. And maybe there's some overlap with this kind of topic. This was more like, where do we need more technical, you know, investigation done? All right, so that's the first one. What's another one?
I think there's, I don't know if this is a specific thing, but just in general, I'm uncomfortable with the sort of armchair approach to legal theory that sometimes comes out of libertarianism. It almost sounds like they're saying, oh, in a free society, this is what the law would look like, as opposed to these are the general principles by which judges making private rulings would influence the evolution of this, you know, market-driven legal process. And so that's it almost sometimes sounds like they're centrally planning the legal system. So I don't know. Do you get what I'm saying, or do you want me to elaborate?
Yeah, well, it might help for folks who have never heard this kind of thing before.
Okay, well, I think that sometimes it comes off as people saying, oh, well, in a libertarian world, and then we, from first principles, we can just reason and know that, you know, this is the way the judge would rule on such and such. And it seems like sometimes those discussions don't leave any scope for the idea that, well, no, the judge is, you know, supposed to be applying the legal principles in novel situations, and there's a sense in which the laws over time. So I guess you could say it's more of a discovery process. And I realize some people are going to say, "Oh, that sounds like Hayek. I don't like Hayek. I like Rothbard." And maybe that's part of the issue. But I'm just saying some of the arguments by which people discuss what the legal system would look like in a libertarian world, they wouldn't. If they were going to say, what would the restaurant or what would the food service industry look like in a free society? You know, they usually have the caveat, like, we don't know, of course, but, you know, probably this would happen or things along these lines. But I'm saying sometimes when it comes to libertarians talking about the legal system, they're pretty sure about exactly what, oh, and what would happen when we, you know, two rival defense agencies, see, they would have previously signed a thing and da, da, da. And it just, sometimes to me, it seems like they're really sure exactly what it's going to look like. And they don't leave scope for the idea that, well, no, we don't know actually for like the things we were saying before, Tom, about, you know, the mineral rights or can airplanes fly over? Do they get permission or how would radio spectrum be allocated? That sort of thing. I think a lot of libertarians would assume that what needed to be done was to just sit down, you know, sit in a room and think about it for 18 hours and then, you know, go and then type it up and say, oh, there, I just solved it. What I'm saying. No, actually, I think it's more that in practice, people would bring lawsuits against each other in a free society. And then private judges who had expertise in that area would render an opinion. And maybe that would survive over time or get overturned. So that's what I'm trying to get at, that I think we hold up the common law, for example, often in libertarian discussions as, oh, this is a great thing. And I think that some of the legal principles emerge out of that, dare I use the phrase, a spontaneous order, and that some, especially like in the Rothbardian tradition, I think sometimes they, because they're so afraid of being nihilistic or something, that they err in the opposite direction, where it's like almost like a centrally planned, like, yep, these are the features of a libertarian legal system, and it gets pretty specific. A different analogy would be, like, we could talk about what if education were truly free, what would that look like? And certainly we can speculate, but we, you know, we wouldn't be able to pinpoint what would the curriculum actually be. And I worry sometimes that's the analog in discussions of a private legal system or judicial framework, and how that comes off is like, oh, the judges would rule this way because they would, you know, believe in the non-aggression principle, and therefore clearly this is the way to rule on this kind of a case.
Okay, so I think, by the way, we've kind of obliquely hitting on a larger point, which is that we get the point that you're making, that we can't in detail answer a lot of these questions in the absence of lived experience and seeing how it works out in practice on the market. And for some industries, I think people would be willing to accept that and say, yeah, of course I can't know how the computer industry would organize itself and, you know, how the firm is going to be integrated, if at all, vertically or horizontally or whatever. I mean, you just have to see. But the trouble we have making the pitch for like a radically anti-state, you know, non-state society is people are willing to accept, yeah, of course, we are ignorant about how some things would work out. But I'm not willing to roll the dice on the actual structure of society itself, namely law and defense. I mean, I don't really want to wait to see how that works out, because maybe it won't. There's a possibility that it won't. And then it becomes a tougher sell, and which is why I never start with those issues. I get them skeptical about everything else. And then by the end, they say, yeah, these things would probably work themselves out.
I mean, that's certainly true rhetorically, and I could see why people wouldn't want to talk about, but I don't think that explains the particular thing I'm talking about, where, in other words, I don't think it's that a devotee of Rothbard or something wants to provide assurance. I think it's more that, no, I know that this is what the way it would work out. Or if it didn't work out this way, then it wouldn't be a libertarian world. I guess maybe that's one way of putting it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I want to make sure we get time to do all the five that you had. But before we do that, a quick word. All right, folks, it's time for a serious chat with your old friend Woods here. One of the things you have to do as a responsible adult is to prepare for the unpredictability of the future, a fact all of us reckon with. And as an adult, one of the things you have to do to provide for the people under your charge is to get life insurance. You just have to. And it's not hard to do. Policy Genius makes finding the right life insurance a breeze. In minutes, you can be comparing quotes from top insurers and finding the best price. You could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. And it's not just life insurance they make easy. They can also help you find the right home and auto insurance and even disability insurance. So if you haven't found a play-by-play breakdown of your future inside a crystal ball or a cookie, that's okay. Be prepared for anything with life insurance. In just a few minutes, you can find your best price and apply at policygenius.com. Policy Genius. We'll always get the future wrong. Better get life insurance right. All right, Bob, what is number three on your list?
So it's related to that. what's considered to be like a libertarian approach to abortion. So it has to do with, you know, Walter Block's evictionism is certainly involved, but it's more general than that. So I'm not just limiting it to Walter's particular exposition, but in general. And I remember when I was younger, I thought this was the great solution that, oh, you know, the libertarian approach saying things like, we can sidestep the argument about when life begins. And for, you know, maybe the only non-arbitrary point is conception, but nonetheless, if the woman doesn't want the fetus to be using her body against her will, well, that's, you know, sorry, but that's it. That's it. And so I think the problem with that, and this kind of ties into the earlier one. So this is just a particularly, you know, hot button sensitive point that people are going to get emotional about, but that it's using sort of like abstract principles and thinking that's all you need to just dive in and render an opinion on something in terms of a legal ruling. And so let me just say more generally, it's not obvious to me in a free society, right? So the whole world is Rothbardian and there's a cruise ship crossing the ocean or, you know, a cargo ship, whatever. And the captain or the crew, they discover there's some 8-year-old kid that's a stowaway. He ran away from home and he thought it'd be an adventurous thing that he goes on the crew on the ship and they discover him while they're out to sea. I don't think it would be legal just to toss him overboard. And yet, you know, that would be the implication of a lot of this libertarian stuff. We say, well, it depends, you know, if the captain's the proxy for the shareholders who own the ship, it's up to him. And, you know, that's tough. But maybe out of the goodness of their heart, they'll let the kid stay. So things like that where I don't think it would just be, you know, a complete tyranny of social justice warriors or something to say in a situation like that, you can't just throw the kid over. Now, you could come up with extenuating circumstances, like if you're in a lifeboat and there's only enough food to go around, but by the time you think you're going to get rescued and somebody swims up to the boat and the people are saying, no, stay away. We don't have enough food for you. And the guy climbs in anyway. Maybe then you can knock him out and throw him overboard or whatever. But in general, if that's not the issue, just throwing the kid overboard because, sorry, this is our property and we didn't invite you on here, you're a trespasser, I don't think that would actually be legal. And so, you know, in other words, not merely just that, oh, well, if a company did that and then the public found out, they would get hurt in terms of sales and so it'd be bad PR. I mean, certainly that's a fallback that even if you say, strictly speaking, yes, that'd be legal, but they probably wouldn't do it in practice. So things like that I think there are areas of the law that just having a, you know, just like starting with the NAP and let me think about this for 3 minutes. And now I know what the answer is, that a judge has to rule this way. Otherwise he must not be libertarian. I think that fails to appreciate how complicated actual judicial opinions are or cases are. Cause normally what happens is there are several principles implicit in the law and in a given case, they might conflict with each other. And so the judges job is to see which of these principles actually applies here or is the more important, or is there some deeper principle at work that kind of, you know, summarizes or gives the earlier ones and now I'm giving the more full treatment. So that's an example of the kind of thing I mean, that it's not that the answer is right or wrong, but I think actual legal principles are going to be a lot more complex in the real world. And that certainly, you know, all the stuff I just said doesn't mean, oh, so that's why we need to have an election every 4 years to have a president who's going to appoint judges and then they have a monopoly jurisdiction. No, of course, the current system's nutty, but I'm saying I think sometimes, certainly among like Rothbardians who are, you know, like to be system builders, I think the vice of that is that they can lead you to think, oh, I just need to reason about this and figure out what the whole apparatus of the legal system would look like in a free society. Just like to say, we don't know what the physics literature would look like in a free society. I'm sure the state has distorted the progress of science. Likewise, we don't know what the legal code would look like in a free society. We need to try freedom first and see, have the best legal minds go into it and, you know, not be perverted by the state. And then let's see what a free society's law code looks like.
Yeah. Okay. I had a lot of people actually wanting to get you to talk about the law question. But we've actually done 2 episodes on the abstract question of private law, by the way. So I'm going to link to those. Of course, we'll have all of Bob's episodes linked at tomwoods.com/1602. All right, number 4.
So this one's more, like, now I'm getting less in terms of the theory, but more like just libertarians and how they argue online sometimes annoys me. I guess, can I do that?
Yeah, why not? I don't think you're alone in feeling that way.
So Wait, it's not that it's annoying, but I just noticed something. So libertarians are often, when it comes to tax, what's called tax incidents, like, oh, tariffs, you know, Trump's going to make the foreigners pay those taxes, right? No. Prices will, like, even if the IRS or whatever at the border said to the foreign company shipping in goods, you have to write a check to us, to the U.S. government. That doesn't matter. What matters is what the world price would be, and prices would adjust. And so ultimately, it's the consumer in the U.S. who's bearing the full brunt of the tariff, okay? Whether that's true or not, because I actually think it depends on elasticities, but let's just say that's okay, fine. But when it comes to the question of income inequality and who pays taxes, and, you know, the Democrats saying people should pay higher, you know, the rich need to pay their fair share, libertarians just quite straightforwardly look and see, well, who's writing the biggest checks to the IRS? And, oh, it's the top 1% of income earners pay, you know, I don't remember the percentage, or a third of it or whatever of the total income tax. How much more do you want them to pay? And so it's a minor point, but I'm saying actually that's kind of inconsistent that, strictly speaking, shouldn't you be checking to see, like, in other words, suppose they do have, Bernie gets in and makes a big surtax on millionaires' incomes. Well, technically, does that mean that some millionaires now might leave the U.S. and go elsewhere? That reduces the supply of millionaires earning income in the U.S., and therefore that raises their pre-tax income such that, you know, once the tax gets levied, they're still, you know, they're not bearing the full burden of the tax. In other words, that's the shareholders or the, you know, the prices of the products that their firm sells that's hiring them. So my point is just, I think there's an inconsistency there where it depends on the argument as to whether you just look at who's writing checks to the government and saying that's the person bearing the burden of the tax. But if that doesn't give you the answer you want as a libertarian, then you'll do the adjustment elsewhere. So that's an example of the kind of thing I mean. So I've seen other examples that I might not be able to pull up at my fingertips here, but things where it's not that in any given application it's crazy or dishonest. It's just the way libertarians tend to handle certain questions seems to, you know, the tools you use or the depth of the analysis differs. And it just so happens that it always ends up at what the libertarian answer is.
All right, fair enough. And we don't want to fall into that, certainly. All right, what's the last one you have?
The arguments over what's called school choice. There are a lot of libertarians that are really big into, you know, voucher programs and things like that. And so I happen to be skeptical of it. You know, I'm very concerned that that's going to give the government even more of a back door. And so that instead of bringing the public schools or the government schools closer to the quality of private schools, I'm worried it's going to be the other way around. But putting that aside, just a lot of the rhetoric, people will say stuff like, and I just had Corey DeAngelis on my podcast, so, you know, I let him answer this charge that I'm going to levy. But they'll say things like, oh, private schools are good enough for Senator so-and-so, like Senator Warren, to send her kids to, but she's just denying that to the average citizen because she's against school choice and things like, and so maybe in some cases there is genuine hypocrisy involved. But I remember, like, when Rand Paul got beaten up and then went to the, you know, hospital, that a lot, one of the progressive critiques was, oh, Rand Paul's not afraid to use his private health insurance, but he's not willing to provide, let everyone get health insurance. What a hypocrite. You know, so it's like that's crazy. That's clearly not hypocrisy. So again, some of the rhetoric that I've seen, a lot of people who would call themselves libertarians when it comes to this issue of school choice, or they'll have slogans like, you know, we're advancing the crazy notion that poor people should have just as much right to an education as rich people. And it's like, you would not use that argument anywhere
in
else.
In any other situation. Yeah, that gets on my nerves also. I was thinking in terms of things where we could use more work, maybe climate change. I mean, I know you've done a lot of work, but in terms of like an ANCAP, mm-hmm. Maybe you're the only one who's really seriously worked on it. And so, I mean, as important as your work is, I'm sure you would be happy to have an extra helper out there.
Sure. Yeah. And even on that one, technically, it's still a working paper that I tried to say, like, what would a free society? So you're right, Tom, just to make for the listener, the way things progressed in the climate change debate, originally, there were a lot of people who were against, you know, government intervention for that reason, who would appeal to the fact that, hey, this it's not clear cut, or the physical science, in other words, to say, don't just take Al Gore's word for it. And of course, this went the whole spectrum too, that the proponents of this stuff conveniently like to label it all as climate denialism. And so my joke is, geez, you can imagine that the grown men still deny there's such a thing as a climate. What's wrong with these people? That's such a goofy term. But then that does lead that's the problem is if you're putting all of your weight on the idea that, well, no, actually, probably global temperatures won't rise that much and maybe the effects won't be so bad. The problem with that is, okay, but that makes it sound like you're conceding, if it were the case that unrestricted by the government emissions of CO2 and whatever would spell disaster for humanity, that then you would need to have a global government action to
right.
stop
so
that.
We need an answer to that.
Right.
And that's what you've been working on. And, you know, we've talked about that a number of times on this show and on Contra Krugman. So I'll also link to those episodes. TomWoods.com/1602 is going to have a lot of great resources for everybody. All right, let's leave that here and we'll pick up on some other topics tomorrow. And then, as I say, as the week goes on, I've got some, you know, some challenging ones, but not ones that old Murphy here hasn't thought of and come up with some kind of clever way of weaseling out of. So, I don't know, of solving. That's more the word I was looking for. All right. And by the way, everybody, if you haven't started listening to the Bob Murphy Show, Bob's podcast, then I don't know what's wrong with you. BobMurphyShow.com is the website. So you should go listen there. I was the very first guest on the Bob Murphy Show, episode number one. So you guys go and listen and enjoy, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.